It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Less than 2 months ago, a grand jury report detailed sexual abuse by priests against children over several decades in Pennsylvania. Keystone Crossroads contributor Laura Benshoff reports that the allegations have prompted some Catholics to leave the church, but others have remained.
During a service at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Montgomery County, there's a pause after the sermon to do what's called passing the peace.
Peace of the Lord be always with you.
And also with you.
In some churches, the peace is a brief handshake with pew neighbors. Here, people roam the aisles shaking hands for nearly 5 minutes.
Peace be with you.
Good morning.
It's way different. It's way different.
For Nicole Gessing, a former Catholic, this is one of many new rituals she's still getting used to. She and her husband Chuck grew up in the Philly area in tight Catholic communities.
Everyone we knew was Catholic. Everyone we went to school with was Catholic. Everyone in our neighborhood was Catholic. I knew two Jewish kids growing up. That was about it.
The church was a big part of their lives well into adulthood. They plan to send their 3 kids to Catholic schools. And Chuck, who's a high school math instructor, says he had a life-changing experience teaching at one.
It was one of the best decisions I ever made. I worked there for 4 years.
But over time, they became frustrated with the Catholic Church. When money got tight, they were let down when the church didn't help them with tuition for their kids. And in 2005, the Philadelphia Grand Jury Report came out. Chuck's childhood parish was named in it for harboring a serial abuser named Father Brischke. It hit Chuck hard, but they kept going to Catholic Church because Nicole wanted to. She wanted them to have something bigger than themselves.
And then as the reports started coming out, I could see him backing down a little bit more. And I don't think I understood the magnitude of it until some of the people that you knew started to kill themselves.
Some of Chuck's childhood friends had struggled with substance abuse and depression. Pennsylvania's grand jury reports don't name alleged victims, so it wasn't until years later that Chuck says he sat down to read the paper and the explanation fell into place.
Jimmy Cunningham, Jimmy Spurrell, John Delaney, Jerry Argyros, all the guys that were listed in the article that came out about St. Cecilia's and Father Brischke, they were all my friends, and I couldn't believe it. I was stunned.
Nicole Gessing was one of more than 200 people from all over the country who responded to a request from NPR about how sex abuse scandals have affected their relationships to the Catholic Church. Many say they left the church for other reasons, joining an Episcopalian or Unitarian congregation. Some, like Diane McGinty from Delaware County, say they still draw comfort from practicing Catholicism, but try to do so on their own terms.
I do like the Mass. I just don't like the institution. I'm tired of it.
Others, like Rick Topper from Montgomery County, simply reject the idea that the church belongs to abusers and people who cover up abuse.
What I do know is that it's not their church. That's what I really do believe that. I think it's our church, and I think they are, to use a biblical term, unfaithful shepherds.
It's hard to say just how much child sex abuse is damaging membership in the Catholic Church in Pennsylvania. According to the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference, about 500,000 people have left the church since 2006. But membership across most Christian groups in the U.S. is declining. And according to the Pew Research Center, the Catholic Church is better than some at retaining those who grew up in the faith. For Chuck and Nicole Gessing, leaving was hard. To them, Catholicism is more than a religion. It's also an identity.
How can I leave the church when the place that changed my life for the better is part of the Catholic Church? And the way I make peace with it is I'm not abandoning my faith. I'm going to a different church to prevent the human bad part of that church machine not to have access to my kids.
After years of moving away from the church, the Gessings officially joined St. Peter's Episcopal Church last year. On a recent rainy Sunday, the sermon there focused all on inclusion.
To welcome someone in the spirit of divine love means to meet that person where they are.
Today's sermon I thought was awesome. It was all about welcoming and acceptance, and that's cool. I mean, that's the way church should be.
Chuck says it's messages like that one that keep his family coming back. Laura Benshoff for Keystone Crossroads.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The trial of East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld for the fatal shooting of unarmed 17-year-old Antoine Rose is scheduled to begin in February. But there have been some recent developments in the case, and here to help us sort through them is WESA's legal analyst David Harris, professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
All right, David, the shooting happened June 19th, but it's not unusual for a trial to only get underway, say, 8 months later, is it?
No, it's not unusual at all, especially a case that will be as complicated as this one. There will be a substantial number of pretrial motions. There will be a lot of activity between now and February, I predict. So it's not unusual. This is not a delay that is out of the ordinary at all.
One of the events that has happened, Common Pleas Judge Anthony Mariani was originally assigned to hear the case, but he recused himself at the request of defense attorney Patrick Tomasi. Why so?
In the legal system, judges have to have the highest degree of propriety in any case. You cannot have any reason to question their impartiality. But not only that, there has to be an appearance of propriety at every stage. And there cannot be anything that causes the public to question that, because the trial is, of course, for the defendant, must be fair to the defendant, but also must reflect well on the justice system, must tell the public that the justice system is functioning fairly. What happened here was that Judge Mariani had appeared on a local cable show early on after the shooting, and he had expressed an opinion about the case and about the guilt or innocence of the defendant, the officer. And that obligated Mr. Tomasi, the lawyer, the defense lawyer, to go ahead and ask for the recusal of the judge because he'd expressed an opinion. The judge might believe that regardless of his own opinion, he could be fair, he could be just, but because of the appearance of his having expressed an opinion, he should not be the one to sit on it. And at first, you'll remember probably, he said, no, no, I'm not going to recuse myself. But after a week and another motion, he changed his mind. And I think it was a good decision.
So Mariani's replacement, Judge Alexander Bickett, quickly ordered a gag order at the request of DA's office. What's the purpose of this?
Well, a gag order keeps the parties, the lawyers and anybody who's directly involved in the case, from commenting on it in public. And the function of that is to make sure that the jury pool, the potential jurors, are not tainted by all kinds of information, one-sided leaks, anything like that. You want to make sure that a fair jury can be selected. And we know that the fairness of the jury pool is already going to be questioned by the defense. So the idea is to try to keep any possibility of tainting all of the potential jurors, which could be anybody who could be called in this county, tainting that pool by extraneous news. It's all going to be tamped down, and people will have to control their desire to go out and talk to the news media and announce things in public.
Okay, so in this case, defense attorney Tomasi made statements to the media in which he said he believed the prosecution was trying to hide exculpatory evidence.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the kind of thing I think that the judge is worried about. I mean, all of these things will be litigated. They will be tried in court. The judge is worried that that public opinion would be swayed one way or the other. So this does not prevent the attorneys from making their legal arguments to the court, not in any way. What it does is it keeps them from making their case in the court of public opinion, which might influence any potential juror.
So the gag order only applies to the parties. Can it apply to families of the victim of the officer?
I suppose it's possible, but this is a gag order on the people who are either parties directly to the case, like the defendant, but it really it's meant to gag the lawyers. I mean, the lawyers are representing the defendant. The lawyers are the people who would make those kinds of statements. The judge simply wants control over the flow of information so that the jury pool stays clean.
All right. So defense attorney Tomasi indicated he would ask for a change of veneer for jurors to be chosen outside Allegheny County and be transported in. So How often is that granted? How often is it requested? And how often is it granted?
It's pretty rare. And the last time that I remember hearing about this was in the case of a very important celebrity trial, Bill Cosby's first case. You remember that's tried outside of Philadelphia. But the first jury, the one in the first case that ended in a mistrial, came from our county, Allegheny County.
And they were shipped to Philly.
They were shipped to Philly. So in order to fight off any potential influence of news and information in the jurisdiction, you could either ask for a change of venue, in other words, to move the whole trial into another county, or in this case, a change of the veneer. The jury would be selected from somewhere else and brought in. So it's an inconvenience to the jurors. It's not as much of an inconvenience to the whole system and the major players in the trial. Either of these, I think, is a long shot here because this has been such a well-publicized event that simply going over a few counties or even a lot of counties, Pennsylvania's quite big, I don't think it's going to solve the problem. But it might be that the judge grants this simply as a way of giving the defendant every opportunity to have the fairest possible trial and protecting any verdict that might come down from an appeal issue, because that's what it would be.
Isn't one of the challenges, though, to find a county that has sort of a racial demographic that's similar to the county where the incident happened? So well, jury pool was similar.
Yeah, it would be a very big difference because Allegheny County or Philadelphia would have one kind of demographic mix of a jury pool, whereas other counties in Pennsylvania, and you don't have to go far outside of Pittsburgh to find this, would have a very different demographic mix. And that could advantage one side or the other. So I think that's something that a lot of people will keep in mind when they decide about, you know, whether this is a fair thing to grant or not, who it gives advantage to.
Finally, given the gag order that we talked about earlier, what are you keeping your eye on next in the Rosfeld case?
Well, I think the upcoming motions that will certainly be made in the case to dismiss the case or to shape how the trial actually plays out will be key. A lot of people don't think about motions as a way that the evidence can be shaped, but I tell my students all the time, motions win trials, sometimes outright and sometimes by shaping the narrative that is out there in the courtroom. It causes the jury to see things one way or the other. The other thing I think to keep your eye on is a lot of people, I think, have already decided, well, this officer has no defense. He very much will have a defense. Mr. Tomasi will not only see to that because he's a good lawyer, but if you look at the law, the case he will make will be that there was reason for him to fear because of the prior drive-by shooting. So he's not without a defense. I fully expect a full-throated defense at the trial.
David Harris is WESA's legal analyst, and he's the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. David, thanks so much.
Always good to be with you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Jackson Browne is one of the greatest American songwriters of the modern age. And if you don't believe me, just ask the more than 18 million people who have bought his records through the years. Browne started out writing songs for other people, but couldn't get a record deal of his own until he sent a demo of Jamaica Say You Will to David Geffen.
Jamaica was the lovely one, I played her well.
Geffen pitched his great find to Atlantic Records president Ahmet Erdogan, and when he passed, Geffen and his partner Elliot Roberts founded Asylum Records and signed him. Jackson Browne turned 70 today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
This is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Some people find billboards disruptive, unattractive, distracting. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley tells us, billboards are one of the oldest forms of advertising and are still a popular way for companies to get their message across.
Good Question listener Norma Bronder estimates that she passes at least 30 billboards on her drive from Squirrel Hill to downtown and says they're eyesores. The largest can be as long as a school bus and as tall as a house. They can be supported by a pole or affixed to a wall. Bronder once heard that Pittsburgh had the most billboards of any city in the country, so we investigated.
We do not have the most in the country, but we were close at one point.
Mike DeWita runs Scenic Pittsburgh, a nonprofit that helps communities draft regulations preventing excessive billboard posting. He says back when steel dominated most aspects of the city, residents weren't thinking about beautifying the region.
So it never occurred to me, as well as anyone else, that billboards, for example, would be much of an issue. Now, the companies that come to Pittsburgh, they want it to be a nice place.
In fact, a lot of the country didn't prioritize its natural landscapes and vistas. It wasn't until Lady Bird Johnson helped draft the 1965 Beautification Act that cities started to realize the benefits of views free of large, flashy billboards. The law regulated outdoor advertising and put restrictions on where eyesores like junkyards could be located. It also inspired groups like Scenic Pittsburgh.
Our job is to go to those communities and develop a zoning code that will protect the people as well as the interest of the community as a whole.
The city of Pittsburgh was the first place in Allegheny County to update its municipal code. Its extensive chapter on signs includes restrictions on luminance, explicit material, and location. Signs can't be within 350 feet of tunnels, parks, and most bridges. They also can't be painted on fences, rocks, or trees. Residential areas must also be void of billboards, unless, as DeWita points out, they were already there. Sometimes the homeowner has little choice about the placement of a sign. This is where things get jargony. There are conforming and non-conforming billboards. Two-thirds of Pittsburgh's are non-conforming.
If they were coming today, the billboard company, to get an okay for that, they wouldn't get it because the law says, no, we don't want that kind of thing in that kind of place.
But these signs can't be taken down either. They've been grandfathered in. New Orleans-based Lamar Advertising owns more billboards than any other company, about 4,000 in the Pittsburgh region. Lamar often caters to national brands like McDonald's or Bud Light because the company has some of the most desirable locations along busy highways. Plus, bigger brands have bigger budgets for outdoor advertising. Those large corporations aren't typical for Mitchell Folks' business, Steel City Billboards.
We basically cater to all local companies. We have a couple attorneys. We have landscaping companies, stuff like that.
He says negotiating the legal side of the billboard industry is a challenge.
Where can we put billboards? Is there a zoning map? What is the size requirements? Is it allowed to have a bracket on the wall?
But he sees value in advertising's contribution to the local economy. Recently, an area garage door company started working with Folks Business and saw results.
We've been able to really help build his brand.
Outdoor advertising can still be the most effective way for small, local businesses to get their message out. And, to answer our listeners' question, there are approximately 1,000 billboards in the city of Pittsburgh. 12 are digital. The title for most billboards, according to Scenic America's assessment of the advertising markets, likely goes to Los Angeles or New York City. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. If you type millennial into just about any search engine, the next few words might not be too kind. Millennials are, quote, killing the hotel industry, the automotive industry. They aren't investing in stocks. They aren't eating cereal. But these headlines do not paint the full picture of what has become the largest generation living on Earth today. Joining me are three millennials who are defying any negative stereotype to make real change in their communities, the millennial mayors. Emily Marburger is the mayor of Bellevue. Emily, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marita Garrett is the mayor of Wilkinsburg. Marita, good to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Matt Rudsky is the mayor of Sharpsburg. Welcome, Matt.
Good morning. Thank you.
All right. So let's begin from each of you. So why did you want to be mayor of your community? Was there a particular issue for you that you felt resonated most in the community, was not being addressed? Maria, let's start with you and go right down the line.
Okay. Similar to Mayor Rutsky, I was on council prior to being mayor. So I served a term on Wilkinsburg Borough Council from 2014 to 2018. So similar to why I ran for council was seeing a need that wasn't being addressed, and not having the best and effective representation in our community led me to run for council, and then seeing the role of mayor not being utilized to its maximum platform is then why I decided to run for mayor to be the best public advocate for our community.
Okay. Emily?
For me, I was really looking to get involved after the 2016 presidential election. It took me a few months to actually settle on running for political office, but it was after looking at the two options I had to vote for mayor in Bellevue that I decided I need to put myself forward and offer a true progressive option for the people of Bellevue to move forward the community.
So it was not immediate that you would run for mayor. It was just that particular choice then? As far as I'm going to run for office. Oh, I'm not happy with the people who are running.
Not necessarily running for office. I knew I was going to help people run. I knew okay. I was going to be an activist. And then it became clear very quickly that it'd be mayor once I looked at my two options.
All right, Matt. Marita mentioned that you two had already held office.
Right. Like Marita, I had been serving on council since 2011. And Sharpsburg is going through an amazing transformation right now. And we're growing younger. And I think the younger generation and Sharpsburg, they wanted a new face to old problems. And the mayor's role in a borough like Sharpsburg is essentially being an ambassador and a champion. And I gave that voice to the whole community so that we can continue on the path of growing in a responsible and sustainable manner.
All right. I want to get a particular issue. Now, Marita mentioned sort of being represented the best possible way as an example. But aside from the representation, was there a very pointed issue that you were concerned about, that your community, that your leadership was not addressing? Matt, we'll start with you.
Yeah, you know, like I said, Sharpsburg is growing very fast, and we've seen an influx of residents coming from the East End, from Lawrenceville, from Stanton Heights, from Morningside. And with that growth, again, we need to keep it responsible and sustainable, like I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And we started focusing on this as a member of council in 2015. And at the time, we had not done a comprehensive plan since 1958, and we started undertaking that process with our neighbors, Millville and Aetna. They've collaborated with us on many things, currently working on a tri-borough eco-district with them. And, you know, marketing and branding and telling people about this has been the key goal. And at the time, we got involved with Town Center Associates. They're a firm that helps with business district revitalizations. We got hooked up with Allegheny Together. We hired a new manager, and it started to take off at that point. So from there, you know, it's all marketing and branding and getting out and telling people, hey, Sharpsburg is a great place. Come join us.
Absolutely. That's exactly what's happening in Bellevue now, though I do believe we're a few steps behind Sharpsburg. When I ran, the stagnancy was a big issue. Mm-hmm. Empty storefronts. Maybe some sidewalks that needed to be repaired. One of Bellevue's biggest aspects is that it's walkable. We have a great walkability score, but what were we walking to? We had a lot of empty storefronts. We had blighted properties.
Right.
And really, it's been about branding. It's like Matt said, selling our borough again and getting people to come to Bellevue for the first time in years.
Now, a taco shop, some restaurants, some
hashtag
fine dining,
a brewery.
Yes.
We are growing. We are definitely growing. A lot of people have been coming to Bellevue, and now it's really to the point where we're like, okay, let's make sure that this is a sustainable growth that we're going to see.
And Marita, what I want to ask you is what particular issue was it that you saw was not being addressed or needed a finer point to it?
Right. Kind of similar to what Matt and Emily said. So in our case, Wilkinsburg, being a blighted community, over 18% of our housing stock is abandoned or blighted. And so that roughly equals about 800 parcels. Thankfully, we've created a blight committee to really tackle that. But that was when I got on council along with new leadership. That's through the work of using my platform as mayor. There's very much a perception issue in Wilkinsburg. Wilkinsburg has amazing potential. We're right in the crux of everything. All roads lead through Wilkinsburg. So we're right off the parkway, the busway. Anytime Squirrel Hill tunnels are closed, people have to drive through Penn Avenue. So really focusing on how to capitalize on that ridership and traffic, but doing it in an inclusive and responsible way to include our residents.
You have banded together in various stages, but one of the first really public moments that people became aware of your working together and collaborating had to do with a letter that you wrote urging State Attorney General Josh Shapiro to take up the case against East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld after the shooting, the death of teenager Antoine Rose. Tell us how you came together on that particular issue and what did you want to convey?
So if I may, because actually the week before we banded together to write a letter about the illegal detention and separation of families of immigrants.
Oh, okay.
And so that, you know, there's obviously been so much happening in our society. So that letter first came. And then after a while, with the initial hurt, the devastation with the murder of Antoine Rose, I reached out to my fellow millennial mayors and said, hey, can we band together for this? This is heavy on my heart, especially in a community like Wilkinsburg. And they were very receptive. And, you know, I'll let you guys take it from here. But
and I mean, really, we're in charge of our police departments. This is something that's so important to us, to make sure that we have our police departments that are focused on the best for our communities, the best for all people in our communities, and that we're focused on making sure that they're anti-racism and that they're doing what's best for everyone.
Matt?
We've been given a platform, and we have a duty to use that platform to affect good and change in our communities. I think the three of us have done an excellent job of engaging residents and visitors on Facebook, on Twitter, and on social media. And as I said, with that platform, we can project that message. And in particular, in Sharpsburg, we have 10 standing general orders. And the first two orders there are community-oriented policing. And I take that to heart because the best way to prevent crime is to stop it before it even happens.
Right. So let's follow up a little bit on that. Police accountability is an overarching issue. And even the quality of the police force, how well they're trained. So how are you addressing that? And because it is difficult for mayors of smaller communities to be able to pay for a qualified, well-trained police force. So how are you dealing with accountability, but also well-trained officers? Maria, let's start with you.
In Wilkinsburg, we make it a priority investment. There's no expense spared because we understand this is for the betterment to protect and serve our residents. So in Wilkinsburg, we have Chief Ophelia Cookie Coleman, and she is one of the architects of community policing.
And she came from the City of Pittsburgh and Police Force.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So, you know, first of all, more than fortunate to have her on board. So it's been great to work with her to amplify some of those initiatives we've already had. But when people come out of academy or the officers come out of academy, it's the bare minimum for training. We have where they have to do at least a 15 additional hours in training. Mm-hmm. So it's an investment in our part.
Emily.
Our police chief in Bellevue, Matt Settner, he's done a great job of making sure that our officers have an exceptional amount of additional training and have opportunities open to them whenever one may arise to further their education. For me, it's been creating an open line of communication with my police chief on a regular basis. If something happens that maybe I don't understand or I feel should have happened in a different manner, we just start that conversation so that maybe I can understand better or maybe he can understand my point of view better. So really for me, it's been that communication with not just the chief, but also the officers that's allowed us to
right.
be best.
Matt, how do you make sure your officers are accountable?
Sure. I come from a unique background when it comes to the police department. My father served as a police officer in Sharpsburg for 41 years, and he served as the police chief for 12 of those years until his retirement. And our current chief, Tom Stellatano, I've known Tom my entire life. He's been with the force for 30 years. I'm 32 years old. And Tom has done a great job since taking over. We've invested a lot in our police department over the last couple of years. We bought 4 new cruisers, all new radios, all new sidearms. We instituted a canine in the department. We have a handler and a canine. Our officers are also getting trained, and they're taking specific duties. So, for example, we have an officer who works with the youth in the community, and we send him to training once a month. We have an officer that's now specializing in the special response team with the North Hills. We have officers that focus on traffic duties. And with that investment, we're seeing the department grow. And with that growth, they're also engaging the community more. Again, like I said, community-oriented policing is number one on my plate. And if kids are playing ball or throwing football, the officers are going to get out of their trucks and shoot hoops or play ball, or they're going to walk the beat and knock on doors and check on residents or check in the business district.
All right. At the start of this conversation, I asked you about what was it? Was there an issue that sort of prompted you to run for mayor? I want to turn that. I want to advance that now. So you're each now months or more into your tenure. What one goal now is most important in each of your communities? Emily, we're going to start with you this time.
Oh, my goodness. it's been so multifaceted, really. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was about taking on as much as I could and seeing what we needed to do. At this point, going back to public safety, my biggest goal is making sure that we're being as effective as possible. And right now, I'm taking an initiative on with our volunteer fire department. Excuse me. We have a bit of a unique situation. We do have a mixed department. We have 3 paid firefighters and the rest volunteered. So that's my big effort right now, is to create a structure that we can operate under so that we're the safest we can be.
All right, Marita, top of your list right now, a goal.
Right. Top of my list is really looking at crime prevention initiatives. One of the things that Matt had touched on is being proactive in preventing crime. So we have restarted with the police department and myself, restarted our public safety forums that will happen on a monthly basis. Additionally, we spoke with police chiefs of Penn Hills, Edgewood, Forest Hills, Swissvale, and Churchill to really discuss the surge of the crime and shootings that we're seeing in our region. The connecting thing in that is that a lot of these actors and the victims are teenagers. So now we're really looking at getting into the root of the problem and addressing gun violence as a public health epidemic.
Matt, number one goal right now.
Yeah, the biggest problem facing Sharpsburg at this point is affordability. And we've seen an influx of new residents coming in. Property values are increasing faster than we ever imagined. The average list time in Sharpsburg is less than a week, and many of the homes are selling for more than asking. And in order to combat that, we are attempting to model a land trust after Lawrenceville's land trust. We are taking part in the Tri-Cog Land Bank. We participate in the vacant property recovery program through the county. And we also partnered with Action Housing. And last year, Action Housing built 2 homes in the community, $200,000 construction per home. And they've both been sold, and they were targeted to families who make 80% of area median income.
All right. We're going to have more with the Millennial Mayors when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're visiting with the Millennial Mayors, Marita Garrett, Emily Marburger, and Matt Rutsky, mayors of Wilkinsburg, Bellevue, and Sharpsburg, respectively. Matt, I want to follow up on something you said before the break, and it had to do with blight and making sure that people aren't priced out of Sharpsburg. Blight can be a problem for older communities. So you've had some success, but with success comes also challenges.
Yeah, so blight was the biggest problem facing the community for a long time. And in the last 3 years, we've gone from over 200 blighted vacant homes to less than 20. And that wasn't wholly through demolition. Only a very small percentage, maybe 10 or a dozen homes have been demolished. And all of that is essentially through growth and a spillover from the East End.
Mm-hmm. So how do you make it that people want to come there, but you don't price out long-time residents?
Yeah, as I had mentioned before the break, we got involved with the land trust, with the land bank. We're working with the vacant property program, and we're working with Action Housing. But right now, we're paying close attention to what's going on in the community. We're advocating for affordability for long-term residents. And currently, there is a 47-acre development on the river in Sharpsburg. More than half of it is in our community. The other portions are in O'Hara and Aspinwall. And it's being developed by the R47 group. And we're advocating with R47 that in this design that they do include affordable houses for residents.
Marita and Emily, how do you balance that? Come live in Wilkinsburg. Come live in Bellevue. We have a good life to offer you here without, again, negatively impacting the longtime residents. Marita, we'll start with you.
Well, for Wilkinsburg, we still have more than enough room. We didn't go down to 20 vacant properties. So like I had mentioned earlier, we had roughly about 800 vacant parcels, and we very much use the county's vacant property recovery program. Thankfully, because of the actions of our Blight Committee, we've received state funding to help demolish over 100 properties in the past 16 months. So in that, we want to, you know, respect and thank and reward our residents who have stayed with us. But obviously, we need new growth in order for us to thrive. And growth, new development, does not mean displacement. And that's where you have effective leadership and people using their platform for good. And also, community engagement is a tool that is really important to me and really using to, you know, involve all of our residents in the decision-making process so that no one can say they were left out.
Right. Emily?
Absolutely. As I said earlier, Bellevue's maybe a few steps behind Sharpsburg at this point. As Marita mentioned, the vacant property program has been great. We've really seen it gaining a lot of traction here in Bellevue. But something we're more concerned about, we have a lot of renters in Bellevue. We're about 65% renters in our community. And whenever we have people coming in and flipping those properties and pricing people out, that's when we're really trying to open up the conversation and making sure that those people aren't priced out of their homes they've lived in for so long. Because Bellevue's on a bus line. We do have a small downtown where people have jobs, where they can go to the doctor. So we need to make sure that they can continue living in their homes where they can afford to live and where they can work.
We have just a few minutes left, and we've learned how you folks work together, collaborate, how you deal with maybe shared challenges. I was talking to Mayor Bill Peduto, City of Pittsburgh, recently. I was asking about you three and about millennial mayors, and here's what he had to say.
What I would like to see is a partnership where we work on similar issues, because a lot of the issues that we address really don't know political boundaries. They're imaginary lines drawn onto a map. When it rains, water follows stormwater tracks. It doesn't follow geographic political boundaries.
All right, so he's talking about partnership, political boundaries that really shouldn't be boundaries to cooperation. We're seeing any collaboration at this point? Do you hope for it? Maria, we'll start with you.
Oh, definitely. I mean, just amongst us, you couldn't get too many different municipalities. You have Wilkinsburg, Bellevue, Sharpsburg. There's also a millennial mayor in Carnegie. So very on the surface seems like different communities, but when we talk, we have the shared problems, infrastructures, how to have responsible development. And so we really are, it may sound cliche, but we're really stronger together when we're sharing what's happening in our region, not only sharing the challenges, but the successes as well.
Absolutely. We're only stronger together. It's been amazing what we've been able to share, what we've been able to open up to each other. We're only going to continue to succeed with each other by our sides.
Mm-hmm. Matt?
I attended W&J for undergrad, and the motto was Together We Thrive. And we've been working together with this group here today. We've worked with Bill Peduto, and anecdotally, to highlight how I've worked with his office, we recently had a couple of catastrophic floods in Sharpsburg, and that was in early July. Bill Peduto's office, Dan Gilman, reached out immediately, and the city sent over a crew to help us. And recently, a couple of weeks ago, our riverfront was flooded again. And, you know, it was just a call away. I got in touch with Grant Gitlin, and they sent over the flusher from the Mon Wharf. And what would have taken our road crew a week to clean, they finished in a day.
All right, we have 1 minute left, so 20 seconds to each of you, and that is this. Have you found strength in being relatively new to politics? We mentioned council and then mayor for two of you. Mayor right off the bat for you, Emily. Have you found strength in being relatively new? Marita, 20 seconds.
Okay, two ways. First thing, not being quote unquote tied into the days of the past. So having a fresh new perspective has definitely been a strength for me. And number two, coming up in a wave or a movement where there's other millennials and my peers that are participating in the legislative process is reassuring.
Emily.
Absolutely agree with Marita. Being unburdened by past decisions, by past connections with people, has really opened me up to being able to change things for the future.
Matt?
It's important to keep an eye to the past, but it's equally as important, if not more important, to keep an eye to the future.
Emily Marburger is the mayor of Bellevue. Marita Garrett is the mayor of Wilkinsburg. And Matt Rudzki is the mayor of Sharpsburg. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, it's the second oldest international contemporary art exhibit. We'll talk with Ingrid Schaffner about the three-year journey to curate the Carnegie International, which opens Thursday. And a conversation with Black Women for Positive Change, who are trying to change the culture of violence in Pittsburgh and elsewhere. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.